Hi there, and welcome to Res Publica, a podcast on the Roman Republic. Episode 0.1, Regnum Romanum. In order for something to begin, something must end. For a new nation to take shape, sometimes an old one ceases to exist. To talk about how the Roman Republic got its start, we need to turn the clock back and discuss the government that came before it. See, before Rome was led by consuls, governed by the Senate, or empowered by its people, Rome was a monarchy. Ever since Rome's mythical founding in 753 BC, Rome's kings held unchecked executive, judicial, legislative, and religious authority over the entire state. The army, the senate, the people, the priesthood. All Romans, rich or poor, patrician or plebeian, senator or slave. The king held the power of life and death over all subjects of Rome. However, even in this near absolutist state of affairs, the seeds of Rome's republican institutions were already being sown. Sure, during his reign, the king got the final say in all matters, whether it was war, diplomacy, law, economics, you name it. But how about when there wasn't a king on the throne? You know, for example, when a king dies. Well, it's actually here where the rest of monarchical Rome got to participate in how their government functioned. See, when the king of Rome died, there wasn't a designated heir chosen in advance to take their spot. No, in fact, the Romans had a unique process in which the Senate, the people, the priesthood, and the legions of Rome all got to play a crucial role in determining who would become the next ruler of the Roman kingdom. See, when the king of Rome died, there wasn't a designated heir chosen in advance to take their spot. No, in fact, the Romans had a unique process in which the Senate, the people, the priesthood, and the legions of Rome all got to play a crucial role in determining who would become the next ruler of the Roman kingdom. And yes, while these quote-unquote old men were from the highest echelons of Roman society, and the kings of Rome knew well to listen to the wisdom of the Senate, the king could still reject or flat-out ignore any proposal the Senate brought forward. Essentially, the Senate could talk the talk, but they lacked really any power to walk the walk. This would, however, change when it became time to pick a new monarch. See, once the king died, the Senate would convene and elevate one of their own to the office of interrex. Now, what is an interrex? Literally meaning between kings, inter rex in Latin, an interrex would act as the sitting king of Rome until a permanent monarch was chosen. This interrex would hold power for a term of 5 days in order to ensure the office holder didn't get too comfortable sitting on the Roman throne. But that wasn't all. The interrex also received a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. While in office, the interrex was to nominate a member of the Senate to become the nominee for the monarchy. If they didn't pick a nominee during their term, then their successor, the following interrex, would get to have this golden chance. After the nominee was selected, the Senate would vote to determine if they approved of the candidate in question. If not, they would repeat this process until a candidate was chosen. Basically, if the interrex acted quick enough, they would literally get to install their own monarch. Now, I'm sure you could imagine all the kinds of favors and gifts a grateful king may grant to any senator who voted them into office. Now, just imagine what kind of favors would be granted to that very interrex who chose them in the first place. So while the Senate appeared powerless, this right here actually made them the power behind the throne, and actually ensured that they held some form of monopoly over who got to be Rome's king. But anywho, if the interrex's candidate managed to receive the necessary votes, then it was on to the next step, securing the favor of the people. Now, when I say the people of Rome, I literally mean everyone who isn't from one of the 100 senatorial families. These were the faceless masses of Rome, the 99.999%. If you thought the pre-Republican Senate was technically powerless, the rest of Rome's populace had no political power, no voting bloc, no civil rights, nothing. The one exception to this, however, was the public assembly. See, in the matter of succession, the people had to be assembled so that they could approve of the Senate's proposed candidate. They would do this by voting in a simple thumbs-up or thumbs-down motion. You know, kind of like you see a lot of crowds do in Roman-themed movies like Gladiator. The people of Rome may not have gotten to pick their monarch, but they were the ones who got the final say on if this candidate could wear the crown. If they said no, the Senate would have to go back and repeat their process of picking a new candidate and presenting it before the public assembly until the people decided, yes, this was the person they wanted as their king. Armed with the approval of the Senate and the public assembly, the candidate could go forward and seek divine approval from Rome's priesthood. According to tradition, Rome's religion wasn't solidified until the reign of Rome's second king, Numa Pompilius. But it wouldn't take long after his reign for Rome's religious institutions to seep into the bedrock of their society. In order for Rome to survive, let alone thrive, the Romans believed that they needed the divine on their side. Religion in the ancient world was not just a matter of individual salvation or spirituality. No, it was a matter of national security. The Romans were especially superstitious, and as such, took every precaution to achieve this most critical task of maintaining the favor of Jupiter, Mars, Juno, Janus, Minerva, Neptune, Diana, Venus, you name it, you get the idea. The priests of Rome would use the tried-and-true methods of animal sacrifices and auguries to determine whether or not the gods approved of their candidate. If good omens were received, and according to our sources they always were, then the nominee in question would move on to the last step in securing their throne, receiving control over the army. To do this, the nominee would make his way back to the public assembly, and after receiving approval from the Senate, the people, and the gods themselves, would formally ask to be bestowed with Imperium. For those of you unfamiliar with the concept, the basic idea of Imperium is that Imperium was the legal authority to command an army in wartime. More than just holding military command, however, Imperium was the power in which the king could exercise supreme judicial and executive authority over all subjects in the kingdom, war and peace, internal and external, life and death. No king could reign unless given these extreme powers, and once the assembly signed off and the nominee received said imperium, the process was complete. Rome had a new king. This was the process in which Rome chose its kings after Romulus, the first king of Rome, mysteriously died in 716 BC. We don't know the exact cause of his death, though Livy gives us a couple of explanations, ranging from the semi-mythical explanation that Romulus disappeared suddenly in a storm, that it was Mars himself who took Romulus up from the Campus Martius to join them in the heavens, to the more likely, though not entirely confirmed story, that he was murdered by a cabal of jealous senators. A foreshadowing narrative, considering what's going to take place near the end of our 500-year-long story. And that's the thing. The story of the Roman kingdom is one shrouded in myths and legends, stitched in with the occasional nugget of historical context. It's also a story I'm not going to obsess over, considering this is a podcast on the Roman Republic and not all of Roman history. But big disclaimer, the first 125 so years of the Roman Republic will face the same dilemma of facts being blurred with legends and propaganda. And don't worry, I'll explain why that's the case later on. Some basic things you need to understand about the history of the Roman kingdom is that, well, it existed, and that there were 7 recorded kings. Now, I say recorded because those are the only ones we know about, and while it's possible, it's not plausible for a monarchy to be so stable that they had 7 successive kings reign a realm on average for 30 plus years per reign. However, it is fair to speculate that this process of ensuring everyone in Rome got some say in choosing their king allowed the Roman monarchs to have an aura of legitimacy that stabilized their regime. After all, how could one overthrow a king that was chosen by the Senate, the people, and the gods themselves? Externally speaking, the Roman kingdom spent its 2.5 centuries of existence warring against its immediate rivals. Mind you, these were not wars in which massive legions battled armies of tens of thousands. No, these were bands of warriors raiding each other's countrysides, stealing cattle, crops, slaves, you name it. However, by the 6th century BC, the city of Rome managed to defeat its immediate neighbors, absorbing all 7 hills it was founded within, as well as neighboring towns and villages, and even founding itself a port in the Mediterranean, the port town of Ostia. Now, this conquest of a handful of towns and villages within a few centuries is nothing to write home to when compared to the expansion of empires of the time, such as the Neo-Assyrians, Neo-Babylonians, the Medians, or especially the Achaemenid Persians that were bursting out of the Middle East, nor the daring colonization efforts of the Phoenicians or the Greeks. But hey, gotta start somewhere. Now we'll talk more about the geopolitical stage the Roman Republic will find itself in once we're in the narrative, say around 500 BC. And I'll keep you updated as the timeline moves forward. But all things considered, right now, Rome was nothing more than an irrelevant backwater compared to the rest of the Mediterranean world. I mean, certainly no one assumed that one day this little town, nestled in the hillsides of central Italy, would one day swallow up 3 continents worth of land and lord over the entire Mediterranean world. And more importantly for our story, that it will be the Roman Republic that sees to this imperial destiny. That's all for now. Join me next time when we introduce the dynasty that will bring about the demise of the Roman kingdom, Rome's Etruscan dynasty. They'll erode the system of legitimacy by transforming the kingdom of Rome into a hereditary monarchy. This system of appointing heads of state through blood rather than merit will inevitably lead to the rise of a megalomaniac so tyrannical that his actions will lead to the overthrow of a 250-year-old kingdom and bring forth the rise of a government never seen before in the Western world, a republic. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I'll see you next time on Res Publica.